Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 28th of August 2011. My name is TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Glenn Pierce, Rev Stan, and Web Cowgirl. Okay, we're going to start off by talking about La Ronde by Arthur Schnitzler. This was a 1900 play, and it is really about the 10 sexual or pre-sexual encounters between various people. Ten characters, and it goes in a full circle. It was said to have been the circling of the spreading of a sort of venereal disease of some description, and it's sort of set in the 1890s in Vienna. I've seen actually quite a lot of adaptations of this. I saw the Blue Room by David Hare, which did this, the Donmar, and also one set in Northern Ireland just after the Troubles called Ten Rounds, which is quite amusing. But I'm not sure if I've actually seen the proper version. Now, Rev Stan, you saw this at the White Bear. You braved the White Bear again.
I did, yes, after walking out the last play. I haven't seen any of the other versions of La Ronde. This is the first time I've seen it. I mean, I've heard about Blue Room, which was the famous one from the Donmar with Nicole Kidman, where she bared her bottom very briefly, which got everybody hot under the collar. And
seat A1, apparently. It's where you had to sit or something.
Oh, right. I don't even want to know why you know that.
No, it was apparently a thing.
Allegedly.
Where you could see where was best to sit in order to see Nicole in full glory or whatever. Okay, sorry. Carry on.
Sorry, we don't digress. So, La Ronde, my initial thoughts of this, I felt that it was well done. You know, it was all very well acted. There was a little bit of awkwardness in places. It's interesting what you said about it being about discussions sort of, you know, around sex. I mean, this being sort of the 21st century, the actors did go for it. It was all under sheets and all done very sort of like modestly. And this is quite early into the production, so there was a little bit of awkwardness around sort of, you know, maneuvering sheets and items and clothing to sort of preserve their modesty, which I think created a little extra awkwardness that probably won't be there in a few performances' time when it's had time to bed in. But I think ultimately, I think it's sort of like one of those plays that potentially I can see why it would have caused a complete and utter furore when it was written, but in the 21st century setting, I just sort of came out thinking, and?
In period costumes and done fairly straight, or was it?
I think it was done fairly straight, but they'd updated it to the 1950s for some reason, and I couldn't see. I think it's one of those places. If you're going to update it or modernise it or change the setting or something, then do it properly and go the whole hog, because ultimately what it's about is morality, and you know. What would have been shocking back then about the fact that people have sex and people of all classes have sex, ooh, shock horror, isn't a shock horror anymore. And there needs to be something else. It needs to examine something else about sort of the sexual relationships and the morality of sexual relationships, I think, in order to really be engaging to a modern audience. I mean, that's my personal opinion, but, you know, I thought it was all nicely done. It was, you know, fair play to the actors for doing something like that, particularly in such a small place. But I came out of it thinking I wasn't quite sure what the point and what I was supposed to be really getting out of it, other than sort of lots of, you know, sort of fumbling under sheets, really. And there's the cynic in me does think that maybe the choice of play comes down more to the fact that sex sells rather than sort of, you know, actually trying to say something interesting. But that's the cynic in me.
Oh, right. So, was it the sort of the grand total of 20 people, or did they have a bit of doubling in there?
No, they had a cast of four.
A cast of four. Oh, right.
Yes. So there was a lot of doubling up.
Oh, yeah.
which did make it a little bit confusing. And I must admit that I got when I got back from it, I did read up a bit more about the play and sort of got more about how it was structured from what I read after it. Because it was a little bit confusing. You didn't sort of initially get all the connections between all the characters and their status and stuff from having just the four actors. I mean, but obviously, like, you know, being able to have 20 actors is quite expensive. And
when you've got
a tiny little theatre, it's just not a possibility. But, I mean, the actual production itself, you know, and I think the acting was pretty good. I thought it was nicely done. I think just from a point of view of taking a play from that period about that particular subject matter and putting it in front of a 21st century audience as well.
Yeah, I always,
there's nothing really shocking about it.
I mean, the thing I always admire, though, is the thing that I'm slightly jealous on behalf of British theatre. That sounds rather pretentious, but it's the Schnitzler was able to get away with being much more sexual than we ever would until, you know, the late 60s in this country. And it's sort of something that simply wouldn't have been done or wasn't done. I mean, it was criticised at the time for being deeply pornographic, but it is a... It was just that in almost all of his writers, he can be grown up about sex in a way that we weren't really allowed to be in British theatre.
Yes.
I think it held us back, held us back for quite a long time.
Well, I mean, that's sort of, you know, in a way, it's sort of, have we actually grown up about sex? Because just looking at, doing some research after I came back from the play, reading about Blue Room, there was more of a furore, more shock about Nicole Kidman bearing her flesh. And then there was about, I can't remember the name of the actor who played opposite her, Ian Glen, who apparently did a cartwheel completely naked. And with lots of full frontal nudity, and nobody batted an eyelid at that, but Nicole Kidman bearing a bit of bottom, and everyone goes a bit mad. So
there's slightly more money in Nicole Kidman.
Yes, naked. But there is sort of a kind of irony there, and
I think also if Ian Glen were better known, I mean, he's her equal in terms of being an actor, but he's not nowhere near as famous as her, as she was at the time, which I think was in the important thing there. Okay, so we'll move on to Batman Live, which has just opened at the O2. Glenn, tell me about this.
No. Sorry, I was just in the Batman theme. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
This sounds oddly fascinating, I have to say.
It is, and interestingly, that theme music doesn't actually appear. So I presume there's a rights issue somewhere along the lines. There's a piece of music that sounds very similar, but not quite. But the actual dinner music, which I've got lots of jokes lined up for, doesn't actually appear. It's a strange one, this one. Is it theatre? Isn't it theatre? There's a quote that the Joker states during the middle of the show that this is no place for Shakespeare. And yes, he's right. It's definitely not Shakespeare, but it is a huge theatrical epic. It's a reported £7.5 million show. It opened at the Manchester Evening News Arena in July. It's now, as you say, transferred to the O2 for 11 performances only as part of a huge world arena tour. It's large scale in every sense. It's a huge set, and plot wise it's paper thin. I'm not a huge comic book aficionado, but I do know a bit about Batman, and there's a huge, you know, canon of stories that they try and fit into 2 hours. It crams in every single major villain that Batman has ever faced in the comic books. So you've got the Joker, the Riddler, Poison Ivy, Scarecrow, Harlequin, Two-Face, Catwoman, all there, all battling the Caped Crusader. It's much lighter in tone than the recent reboot films, Dark Knight, the Christian Bale films.
Is it closer to the Tim Burton stuff, though?
It's mostly more closer to the sort of 60s
So it's TV. More Adam West TV era. Although, I have to say, I'm looking at the trailers, the look of things looks slightly more towards the Tim Burton reboot kind of costuming, I thought. Just looking at it, I mean, the sort of the Batman suit is not quite so comic, you know, it's not quite so sort of one-man jumpsuit with the pants outside type thing.
No, it's a strange hybrid. I mean, the real spectacle of the show is a 100-foot-wide video wall that's the back of the set, and it does some amazing 3D projections that sort of takes you right into the heart of the story. In a way, it's quite, let's say, quite old-fashioned, harking back to the sort of original comics and the original TV series. You have the turning comic book pages, the original sort of illustrations, but it then does sort of mix with the more recent films. Plot-wise, it is very flimsy, but it is stunning to look at. I mean, it's as you would expect. The aerial work is stunning. Batman's first flying entrance does impress. He appears from the back of the stage, and even though you're sort of expecting him to fly in, it does sort of get a gasp from the audience. There's some wonderful special effects. I say lots of circus work. Half the cast, it's a cast of 40 odd plus, half of them are from Circus Space, so half are circus trained performers, the other half are sort of traditional actors. So that combination really works. The circus performers, you know, it fills that really large arena. There's some nice set pieces, there's some huge pieces of scenery that do appear. Special effects are very good. There's some nice illusions. Plot-wise, I say it does fall back slightly. I think, you know, from a family entertainment, it works. If you can go along, enjoy the story for what it is. Don't expect perhaps the shade and the darkness that you get in the recent films. If you go back to the sort of traditional, I say, original TV series, the original comics, the sort of, without wishing to be a pun, the cartoon fight nature of it and that sort of side. Really fun. Interesting to see they are hoping to tour this for quite some while, and they're hoping, there was talk to bring it back to London. It'll be interesting to see if that works. The O2 Arena, when I saw it on the second night, they'd closed the top level, and even with moving people down onto the one level, it was about a third full. Obviously a huge amount of seats to sell in the O2, but it was noticeably quiet for that second night. Other people I know have been over the weekend said it's been busier, so if it's perhaps just, you know, the family audience over weekends, but I think they may be struggling to fill it. And sort of continuing last week's theme, when we talked about the excessive prices of South Pacific programmes, which were £6 each, Batman Live has nothing on that. Programs there, a shocking £15.
Gosh. Oh dear. Yes, well, I suppose it's again seen as a, it'll be seen as a souvenir, won't it? But yes, then it's a bit excessive, isn't it? Okay, we'll start talking about now about Wittenberg, which has just opened at the Gate Theatre. This is I quite like the idea of this play. It takes two fictional characters and one real character, Martin Luther being the real character and Dr. Faustus and Hamlet being the two fictional characters, and assumes that they all met at the University of Wittenberg. Rev Stan, you saw this as well. What did you think of it?
Shall I tell a bit more about the story?
Yeah.
Basically, Hamlet is at university, as we know from the play, and his tutors are Dr. Faustus, who's teaching him philosophy, and Dr. Martin Luther, who's teaching him theology. Now, Luther and Faustus are the two sort of key characters in this. It's prior to Luther nailing his 95 thesis on the church door, which was sort of like seen as the birth of Protestantism. Lutheran and Faustus represent two opposing views, but are actually friends. They like to go down the pub and have a few beers. Faustus very much likes to live life to the full, wine, woman and song, and he does sing a couple of songs. It's not a musical, but he does sing a couple of songs, but that's okay.
Yeah, I thought you were going to bolt at that point when he started singing.
No, that was fine. It was in the context. It was fine. And Luther, in contrast, is sort of very serious and struggling with the fact that he's having a lot of thoughts that put him in conflict with his traditional beliefs and the traditional beliefs of the Catholic Church. Now, thrown into this mix comes Hamlet, who's having problems with dreams, and he turns to his two tutors to help interpret his dreams. He's also having problems with his tennis game, and I know you got a bit upset by the fact that they were playing lawn tennis rather than
real tennis,
which obviously would have been around in the 16th century, not lawn tennis. But anyway, we'll brush over that. So Hamlet gets embroiled into this sort of debate going on between the two tutors about I'm just frantically looking through my review.
Well, it's really about his, it's all kind of about his major, whether he's going down the Hamlet's going, I thought it was, but whether he was going down the theological route rather than the philosophical route. You know?
Yes.
Is he going to be religious or is he going to be rational?
Faith versus reason. They're the two words. It's faith versus reason. So you've got that debate going on. But what I liked about it, it's obviously very, very clever. There are some brilliant references to lines from Hamlet and Dr. Faustus. It's very intelligent. It's very funny. It's well done. It's very clever. And if you like the sort of thing like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, then you will enjoy this. I thought it was just a brilliant bit of theatre. Shows again the gate punching well above its weight. Brilliant production, very well sort of staged in tiny little theatre with tiny amount of space, but they really made the most of it. Quite imaginative staging, brilliant acting. Loved it, loved it, loved it.
Yeah, I thought it was very good. As you say, it was very clever. I mean, lots of little bit of historical research that sort of jumping in there. You know, the introduction of coffee and thing. The tennis game, although I objected to it being lawn tennis, it was in fact very well done as a sort of a prelude, because of course he was playing against. He plays against Laertes.
Yeah.
So basically, yes. I'm sorry if that's a bit of a spoiler, but it's kind of like the duel from Hamlet. The lines are very similar to the final duel scene from Hamlet, although it's played out as a tennis match, which was quite amusing. I did think they underused the woman who had to play four different parts and really was not very, not very well used, I thought, in that.
No, but it's one of those plays that you could go back and see time and time again, and you would be constantly noticing new things and new little, you know, lines that you didn't notice before, and little plays on lines from Hamlet and Faustus. It's definitely one of those plays that you could see over and over again and get more and more out of.
Yeah, we should point out, I mean, it was Sean Campion who played Dr. Faustus, and Dr. Faustus really is the person who comes out best of it, and it's just before he gets to the beginning of the history of Dr. Faustus, the play, and I think he's slightly more fun than I've seen, because we recently saw a Dr. Faustus in the Globe, and or you perhaps didn't, but there has been recently one, and he's a lot more fun than that Dr. Faustus. This one, you know, who was rather solemn.
He does sell his soul in this one, but you imagine from the traditional story.
No.
But that's what's clever about it, is there's sort of little twists on the sort of traditional stories and the, you know, the traditional telling of the Hamlet story that are quite nice.
Yes, I do wonder though if it helps if you've seen quite a lot of these things. I mean, I've seen Dr. Faustus, and although I think you studied a bit the relevant part of history, so knew quite a lot about Luther, and I got my information about Luther from John Osborne's play. It was on the National about 10 years ago. and also I know Hamlet extremely well. So we you know, because we know those plays, you get an awful lot out of it. And I think that I think it's still entertaining if you didn't know about it, but it is a slight worry that it might be caviar for the general, if I can use my Hamlet quotation. So now we're going to talk about Crazy for You. This is at the Open Air Theatre in Regent's Park. They've had quite a reputation for good musicals recently. Now, Web Cowgirl, tell me about what you thought of this.
Well, I have heard about these good musicals, and I have to say I was enticed to go based on a series of positive reviews in the Twitter sphere. And I am a big fan of the traditional Golden Age Broadway musicals because the song style is suited to my personal taste. And this was a little bit questionable because it's not actually a Golden Age musical. It's sort of a recreation of one using songs from the Golden Age, but the show, you know, was written in the, I think it was 1982.
1992, I've got written
1992.
Down here.
My apologies. So it's you know, it's new actually in many ways, sort of it's actually a lamb dressed like it's actually mutton dressed like lamb. No, it's lamb dressed like mutton. That's it, because it is actually a new show, pretending to be an old show. I went in feeling very skeptical anyway, because the whole concept of taking these songs that weren't originally created to go together and making a sort of pastiche of the feeling of a musical, I just I thought, well, this just really probably isn't going to work, but I've heard there's some nice dancing in it, so you know how I can get really, you know, curmudgeonly when I go to see shows. I hate to think that I'm always expecting to be disappointed. But most often when I have my hopes set really high, it doesn't really work so well. But I have to say, this is definitely the situation where I went in with low hopes and I left feeling elated. It started out with sort of like one of those standard Broadway musical kind of scene. And I've been watching all of these Busby Berkeley musicals with my best friend lately. Gold Diggers of, I think, was it 1933, and 42nd Street and things like that. And you could see scene after scene drawn out of these old musicals as the guy with a, you know, as it were, a song in his heart goes to try to impress the impresario and get onto, you know, the big stage. And this is what this guy was in 1930s New York, trying to tap dance his way into this review. And I was, you know, well, you know, yeah, some dancing, good, good. And then he is called off by his mother, who says, "Why are you wasting your time doing this ridiculous tap dancing stuff again?" And he's like, "Oh, Mom, you know, but I don't want to work for the family bank." And she's like, "Well, that's too bad. I've got a job for you to do. Do it." And, you know, hands him something. And then they sort of transition into this number in which all of the showgirls that they just had backstage while he was doing his audition show up dressed in varying shades of blue, pretending to be telephone operators. And it started slipping into that almost surrealism of the Busby Berkeley musicals. And he makes a phone call to his mom and the girls are talking back and forth to him. And then like the magic happened and I completely lost my sense of remove and disinterest and, oh, this isn't going to be so good. And I got completely sucked in and I just kind of, you know, I just was laughing and having a good time the whole way through and feeling actually a little bit embarrassed about how much I was enjoying myself. And I could see the songs actually didn't do the kind of narrative and character building things that they do in a musical when they've been written for it. You know, the best example I can think of being Annie, Get Your Gun, where every song really, it moves the story forward, and illuminates character, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. So these songs weren't doing it. They were like pop songs, basically from the, I'm thinking the maybe 20s, 30s, and 40s, by the Gershwins. And the guys, there were these two young gentlemen sitting down the row from us, kind of humming along to the songs with just this sense of joy. And gosh, you know, actually, they were still really good songs, even if they didn't work to, weren't really the songs for the musical. And to make it even better, in addition to the like really fantastic dancing, there was funny dialogue. When the people, they, one of the routines, they seem like some of them might have come from old movies somewhat, but the characters, it's not just that the lead two characters, the banker and the sort of cowgirl that he falls in love with in Polly in Dead Rock, Nevada.
It's Sean Baker and Claire Foster, would it?
Yeah, they. I have to say, now he had that kind of proper musical theater, shiny black hair, shiny black shoes kind of look for him. But she had like really, really long hair, and they played up her whole cowgirl thing. They did a lot of bickering with each other. Well, he never bickered with her, but like the dialogue was really sharp. But then all of the other characters, there were actually, I think, at least two other romances happening at the same time. And so you had like a lot of electricity and a lot of dynamic dialogue between these people. And it's funny that it was written in 92, because I almost felt like it had a little bit of the sitcom to it in terms of how quick the repartee was. But gosh, you know, it actually had me laughing, and it had the whole audience laughing. And I felt like I completely lost my ability to be a critic about this show or be critical about it, because I loved it so much. And at the very end, when, as you expect, the hero and heroine are united and they're standing there, you know, singing their song of love and joy to everybody, and all the chorus girls come out, and it is like the end of the Busby Berkeley musicals when they have the amazing final musical sequence and they pull out the stops for the costumes, and the chorus girls had on these ridiculous feather headdresses and all diamantes and glitter from their toes to the tips of their fingers, and looking as gaudy as all get out. And when the very last girl showed up in this astounding, almost Cher-like level of ostentatiousness in a costume, and makes her big reveal, because her costume has a trick, I actually started crying a little bit because I was so happy. So I have to say, I walked out of Crazy for You on the most incredible high. And all of these other people, despite the fact we started getting sprinkled on just a little bit towards the end, were saying things like, and I think this is a way of saying that they were enthusiastic, "That really wasn't so bad, was it?" Just like the two guys in the Muppet Show.
Yes, having low expectations.
Yeah, so that was wonderful. And I have to say, my first thought was, when can I see this again? And my schedule is really full for the next couple of weeks. It's closing the first week of September, and then I joined the Twitter list for the show, and it turns out it's being moved to, I think it's the Novello, so it's getting a transfer. And it should be starting in October. And apparently the person who heard this and broke it was Baz. So the cast was hoping that it would happen. However, someone else has pointed out that both of the previous two shows that were there were supposed to transfer and didn't. So I have to say, if you're the kind of person who absolutely loves Golden Age musicals and you're willing to be a little bit flexible about the canon, this show is an absolute must-see, completely a treat. we paid full price for our tickets, and my husband actually said that he really felt like it was worth it. And I certainly did. It was unmitigated joy from almost, you know, the start to the finish. So, which contrasts really strongly with actually another musical that I saw.
Yeah, you saw a production of Top Hat that's touring. It was in Milton Keynes last week. I think it's in Birmingham this week. This is Top Hat with Tom Chambers, who won Strictly Come Dancing a few years ago, and Summer Stralin, who's one of the Stralin sisters. Yeah.
Yes, and I went to see it because I'm a Summer Stralin fan. Ever since I saw The Drowsy Chaperone, I've been convinced that she was the top girl for me on the list of triple threat talents on the West End. That she had the best singing, good acting, and outstanding dancing. So if you're going to see a show where you needed someone who could really move and really carry a song and be, you know, lively and enjoyable on stage, like Summer was, she was the thing. So I've been dying for a chance to actually see her in a show where she was doing some dancing again. I thought she was just tremendously wasted in Sound of Music. I'm sure she mustn't have thought that. It was probably a good gig. But I wanted to see her dance, and I don't remember the scene in that where there's a dancing nun. Anyway, so I actually traveled all the way up to Milton Keynes to see the show because, you know, like I said, I love Golden Age musicals. It's based on a show, a movie from 1935, and in fact, much like Crazy for You, it is a pastiche. It's the original movie didn't have a whole lot of songs, so they've added extra songs in from the.
Other Esther Rogers films, isn't it?
I thought it was other songs by Irving Berlin.
Yeah, right.
Yes, music by Irving Berlin, because Berlin's got a thing in all of his contracts. And I think that this is the estate is carrying this forward, that you cannot mix Irving Berlin songs with other songs. So I thought Irving Berlin songs, 1930s movie, tap dancing. And like I just said, you know, I told you what a good time I had at Crazy for You. And I thought, well, this is perfect. It's going to suit me completely. But as it turns out, it didn't quite hit the mark. The story is one of those silly, fluffy, mistaken identity things, and to be honest, it's no more ridiculous than a 1930s banker going to Nevada and saving a dying theater. But it appears that they actually hadn't been rehearsing it, or at least not the main characters. They've only been in it for like a week or so before opening. And I'm hoping actually that they were doing quite a bit more with the ensemble, because there's actually not just, you know, it seems to be like it's fairly easy to get, you know, a group of women dancers together, say like 9 or 12 or so. But they also have a complete complement of men for this show, for the tap dancing numbers. Those numbers were actually fairly good, but the stars, I don't want to say so much that they didn't have chemistry, but there's just this thing in the show where everything's jellying and everybody's snapping and crackling off each other, and they, you know, the kind of thing where you could easily slip in a little bit of an extra joke because you've been doing it so long, and it just didn't feel like it had gelled yet.
It is very early in the tour, so hopefully that will come together later.
I think that there's a good chance that people who see this show later on are actually going to get a little bit more of a magical experience like I was hoping for when I went and saw it. Tom Chambers is a slick tap dancer. He, you know, definitely has got it. I think they might have maybe gone ahead and been a little less faithful to the original in favor of giving his character a bit more personality. Because there's like a certain style with the way that they did things in the 30s where the men were very kind of distant and trying to look suave. I don't know if you know what I mean, but just see, he wasn't coming off as being particularly charismatic, despite the fact that he was an excellent tap dancer. And he felt like he was, you know, maybe he's just not a very good actor, because he wasn't selling me on the character at all. He wasn't. I didn't buy that he had gone from "I will never get married" to falling in love with someone in 5 minutes. And that's, you know, it's definitely a trope from the era, but you want to see him win. You know, you want to have empathy for that character. You want to see him get the girl. And Summer was a lovely dancer, and I was really happy that she, you know, got a solo number. Of course, you would have expected it. And she looked pretty snazzy in these crazy outfits that she's obliged to wear for the show. But her character is supposed to be a real hard ass, and yet I think still charming. Ultimately, I never thought either of the two leads came off as sympathetic. I couldn't help but notice that the people in the audience were roaring and absolutely thrilled, and you cannot say that the dance numbers weren't fantastic, but I think that this show probably is going to be quite a bit better as it has a chance to settle. So probably, I think it'll probably be good about the time it gets to the Salford Lowry, which will be good news for the rest of the people who are on the tour. I actually don't think this is really going to hit it in London. It's not.
I know they're hoping to get it into London later next year, so yeah, we'll have to see.
Well, I, you know, maybe it'll be so great that people will love it. The thing is, it definitely, for the audience that I went to, that where I was sitting with in Milton Keynes, were a lot of people in their 50s and 60s, and they were just thrilled to pieces. But I don't know if those people are the ones who'd be traveling into London to see this show again. And I don't know if London theater audiences, if this is really their kind of show. So maybe they'll actually tour it in the peripheral theaters that are on, like, you know, the ambassadors list. But I don't imagine this actually settling in for a run, because I don't think London audiences really would appreciate it. But Crazy for You was actually so funny and dynamic. You know, of course, what do I know about what people like these days? I believe that it was so funny that it'll probably have like a nice little 2 or 3 month run. But I actually have a hard time imagining Top Hat being able to fill it that way, because I think the London theater audience skews a little bit younger than it does up in Milton Keynes.
You can get in touch with the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast on Twitter at AYULTP, going to our Facebook page, the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast, or going to our webpage, ayu-londontheatre.org. Thank you, and goodbye.